You live in the book.
They don't care. Language probably going to be lengthy on the ballot, isn't it?
On what?
The inclusion.
Well, it doesn't have to be.
Because we haven't seen anything yet, and I'm scared to death it's going to be crazy long.
Here's the way it works. The statute provides the language for an inclusion.
How are you?
I'm dressed.
And it basically is, shall the following real property be included within the Wheat Ridge Fire Protection District with following conditions? Well, all it really, then you'll have the legal description, but I believe the property they're including is just Edgewater.
Right.
So all they need to say, is the current jurisdictional or municipal is of the city of Wheat Ridge, Edgewater.
Hey, how did that work out with getting?
And they don't have to list exclusions?
No, because it's what the boundaries are, and the boundaries include the exclusions. So you know what? I'll get involved.
Which is because that will cost them.
Oh, I know. And then because the attorney, because I've done a lot of inclusion elections in the last, since Tabor, and it's never been a Tabor question. It's because it's statutory, and shall they be included? And then we say a condition is they shall be subject to the mill levy of that district. Then you're not doing it. Shall the taxes be increased?
Right.
No Tabor notice, none of that. And so then all the conditions would say, you know, pursuant to an inclusion agreement, which I don't know, I'm just guessing.
Right.
And
hello, how are you?
Hey there, how are you?
Good to see you.
Good seeing you. And subject to the, you know, mill levy.
Good to see you.
Although I've been at your office.
That's what I was worried about.
Managed to catch sight of you.
Exactly. And I know it's not Edgewater, but you know.
Like, are you okay?
Sure.
Yeah. My office would be the one
riding the herd on a whole bunch of cats.
I just did an inclusion dissolution election. We dissolved one district.
Those guys,
all of that boundaries when it was included into the St. Green Sanitation District. And so I did both elections. Same ballot, same electors.
Right.
And that's exactly what I should have the following property being included. All the property and blah, 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 sanitation district.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody today.
Otherwise, it's been 8 pages of legal description, which is
awesome. Right. That's what I'm worried about. I'm going to send it back and say, you don't want to do this.
The electors wouldn't know, and my part of it, or they wouldn't know their part of the city of Edgewater.
Yeah, the number of emails that I get. My law firm, we didn't use to have our emails listed on the website.
Because it obviously means that that attorney and that legal have never done it before, and I've done it ten.
Well, I'm just glad that they've got somebody at all.
And just because.
Yeah, they can't. No, I live in Wheat Ridge. I know.
Yeah.
They actually wanted me to run.
Yeah, they got our number.
My neighbor. And I'm like, filmed
well, and I got the phone line, the number that I don't recognize, because 9 times out of 10, it's somebody helping money.
Oh, sweet, but no.
I'm honored. There's
calls sometimes a day, and we call the office line, then the cell phone line, and back to the office line.
You know, we just.
Yeah.
Well, what I've done.
And you know, I'm all need a concealed carry in the board meeting, so.
I've got several numbers from weird places to memorize now because I know who it is. Never been through one like this before.
Never since it's changed me.
I agree.
Why?
Definitely.
Five districts have so many.
Well, actually, we're talking about
the same people.
I mean, and it's like Like everywhere you live.
Yeah, you got to talk to the Supreme Court about that. Right.
I would love to.
Well, so funny you say that, because I was about to say all the recalls I've done have been in Patrick District. The volunteers trying to get the board. And then I got a voicemail. I called her back, but she didn't answer. Karen Long.
She's got a really interesting
Anytime you go out.
Yeah, and really it's shared with a rap hall. And she's a And it has to be the county clerk where the administrative office is, which is in Adams County.
Right. Well, okay. So, I mean, Karen is in Nancy Doty's, right? And I guess her daughter-in-law. So it's worked out well. It worked out that it's good that the administrative office was.
Yeah, that's what the recall statute said. That's what the recall statute said.
Yeah, no, right. Well, she was hoping that it wasn't because she says.
Yeah.
It has so many school districts, and that's why.
If you would right here, because that's where your.
And so does Adams County.
If you don't mind.
See another data.
Yeah.
Which I'm grateful for, although it's, you know, wasn't.
I used to work.
Chairs are around the same size.
The table's slightly.
Yeah.
A little bit around.
How are you?
Some folks will say you really can't.
Okay. Yeah, I was just saying. Everything feels formal. Yep. Like August 1st, everybody woke up.
Yeah, so like exactly right. We've been planning and working for months, but.
Oh, yeah.
Except for the president. We just saw them way early.
Oh, yeah. Get out of my office.
I don't want.
Here's this big red book.
Read it.
Yeah, I've been pounding our clients to, you know, firm up their decisions because some of them are still on the fence until their board meeting. And the board meeting's like, we'll have one. The board meeting's on August 27th. I'm like, sign this agreement. I forgot I have two others with you.
I have a couple that are slow.
Yeah. And I just signed it and we'll.
To get some new stuff right.
Board of Ratify.
No, I signed Wheat Ridge's, City of Wheat Ridge's today.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're still waiting.
Next meeting.
It's the first meeting. Yeah. It's we go and stuff like you.
Gotcha.
Actually, very high quality stuff. They do good job.
Yes, October, I think every October is residence rights month for a long-term care facility, sure, what you guys call.
Oh, really?
And so this year, I decided the theme would be voting.
My daughter.
Good.
As a dog.
Which is awesome.
That's good.
Apropos for me. Okay, yeah, I'll look at my schedule and see if I can come. So there's events, get out the voting bags.
Yeah, would you like kinds of stuff? Somebody come with you?
But it's worth it, you don't have to do any.
I haven't had,
Well, can't you take it back for refreshers to you can?
Which is actually a legitimate way of boarding and refreshing.
Okay, we've already got our.
Wow.
Our HCF room.
Isn't that called instead of in
all that stuff going?
Good. I just
share any information you might need.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Just got an email about Mesa County.
No, ours aren't there. We've decided we're going to drop.
Event and somebody from the clerk's office.
Let's take someone else.
Yeah,
that's what I.
There's one in Colorado Springs.
Take Carol Murray's and drop the gear.
Yeah, right.
I will.
Well, they're all elected residents.
They shouldn't be as much.
Well,
you're not part of the federal, right? You know, aren't part of.
So while I've got you all here, before we get started, let me run something by you. We have to this point. We have thus far in our life as a group tended toward presentations on our side. So we sort of give you stuff. And we've done, I think, probably not as effective a job at getting you involved in particular issues and engaging you in ways that allow for you to be a participant in the conversation. So one of the things we'd like to do, we'll try it today. This is sort of more in the old style, but one of the things we'd like to do going forward is present things in ways that allow you to be more engaged in it, or maybe even have a pretty good understanding walking in the door, maybe even form subcommittees to deal with particular issues, or have you as members of the commission talk to the rest of us on particular issues that you have particular insight in. So I welcome your thoughts on how to do that, or particular topics which would allow that to happen. So we can talk about that now, or you could certainly throw something out to me in an email, and we can follow up that way. Did anybody have any thoughts on that? Or I suspect that you would find it to be a more invigorating process, too, if you were had more of a upfront stake in it. Nikki's got that look on her face.
Like, no.
No, that's a different look. Okay.
I'm just trying to visualize this whole big thing.
Oh, I'm a visual person, and I have to visualize everything. So.
We got a little election coming up. It's like a tour.
That would be great. Actually, we could go on a road trip. Would you guys like to go on a road trip?
That'd be great.
Road trip.
I think that would be really cool. And
there's this great little restaurant for lunch on the golf course right on campus.
Nice. Wait a minute. Well, if you're paying, we're all out there together.
It's got a deck. It's awesome.
And we can see they have a mail sorter. Pitney Bowes mail sorter, which is really something to see. Are you thinking during the actual election? So
would you have to be observers from your office?
No, we would have to designate people. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great idea. So we would be 22 days out is when? You probably know this off the top of your head.
The
76 right now, right?
Yeah.
And,
the 14th, somewhere around that.
So you probably want to do it between the 14th and the 6th. Mm-hmm. At some point along that.
Yeah, the week of the 15th, I think, is when the ballots go out.
So probably the 16th forward, because I don't have it
when
on my
When do you
calendar.
Start processing? I know under law you're restricted to some degree.
Yeah, it'll probably be the following week, because we generally don't receive a lot of ballots that first week. So the week of the 22nd, towards the end of that week.
So toward the end of the 25th, 26th. Well, and the thing is, this is such a sort of a low-interest election.
It's not feeling at all like a presidential yet.
Okay, so we're thinking maybe last full week in October?
Mm-hmm.
So toward the end of that week, maybe like the 25th or so?
24th, 25th,
Would you mind going in the office?
That'd be
really
awesome.
Yeah.
So, time of day?
After 10, because that's when we'll get our, we'll get our mail processed and
Okay,
brought in from the post office. So,
if you can find it, my desk.
Do you want a convenient one? Because that would be
typical.
Time?
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be great.
So maybe 1 o'clock on the 25th.
On the 25th.
Nice.
Ooh, Josh is gonna kill me.
You're giving him lots of fair warnings.
Okay, I will send out a notice on this so that everybody has it. But I just want to make sure it's the 25th at 1 o'clock, and we'll meet at the Taj
I'll send you something because our elections office is at
the other location. Yeah, okay. Great.
No, just that would be.
And maybe the restaurant's name as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. We'll be there before.
That Fossil Trace Golf Course.
Uh-huh.
I'll send you the info.
Cool.
Super. And then generally, so that's a great kickoff. But hopefully going forward, we'll do more of that kind of thing to get you guys thinking and seeing about the things that we do. And less of us sort of talking at you, because that's been how we've been doing it recently.
By the same token, I think some of the presentations have been very good.
Oh, well, thank you. That's excellent to know. As today's will be, I'm sure.
Wake up, Michael.
I like to think it's more of a discussion than a presentation.
There you go. See, and that's where there, we're trying to get into that.
I have a question about the 25th. So is will the entire afternoon be devoted to the tour? It seems like that would be a long tour.
We could take up at least an hour and a half of your time with the tour, just, you know, just the tour and questions. And, you know, we could do a quicker one if needed, but...
So basically, you're going to show us how you collect the ballots, how they enter your office, what you do to process them.
It's sort of like how a bill becomes a law.
It's just like the
ABC. So tell Josh he has to put a song and dance.
We're actually thinking about doing
that's
a
video. That's the part that Josh doesn't want to do, is the song and dance. That's the part that Josh is trying to avoid, is the song and dance.
Yeah.
We all are actually excited. And then the Pitney Bowes process, maybe even signature verification, which
signature
would be a great thing to
learn. Tabulation, cool. Our ballot building process.
Now, I have heard, rumor has it, that there are a couple of counties that are doing automatic signature verification this year.
I'm not one of them.
Is it your Pitney Bowes? Is it set up to do it?
It does have that potential, but we're not prepared to go
not
there
going
quite
down,
yet.
Down
yeah,
that
we
want
to. Just sort of testing on that first.
Okay. Well, that's clearly a county function, so at this point it's not something we've really got nose into much.
No, it has great potential. I think that's really great. And our system's just different than the other folks' systems, so that's in development right now for automatic.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. We actually, you know, you brought us kicking and screaming into the mail ballot sorting era. But it actually has worked out really well because the other counties that have gone to Runback and Valhall and Yesness, is that the other one?
Mm-hmm.
They're using the parameters that we set up for Pitney Bowes, mm-hmm. and they're just sailing through.
Yeah, the first always has the brain damage.
Yes, that's right. All right, I think we are ready to go. How do we do that?
We're rolling.
Oh, we're rolling. Oh, well, great. Who knows who's been listening to us? So today's topic, we'll first start with minutes. Did everybody get a chance to flip through the minutes that you have in front of you? Were there any thoughts on the minutes? Any corrections you wanted to note? I think it's that one right there. Yeah, that's it. Now, the great thing about our minute setup is that it's basically just an outline of the things we discussed, because then you can always go back and listen to the audio. Did anybody want to make a motion on what to do with the minutes?
We have a quorum.
Faith. That's a very good point. I think under the bylaws, we require 60%, and I'm not sure that we have a quorum. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think we have 15. We don't have a quorum. Thank you, guys. We'll punt this until next time.
And I would have had to abstain, so.
Would have messed it up anyway. I don't believe the secretary is going to address us for today's meeting, but let me skip right down to topic one. I should note, by the way, that three of our county clerks are not here today. It's a very busy time. Pam has made time to come visit us, but it's a very busy time for the county clerks, for county offices. I would note that of the three county clerks that we have on the board, they are all Hart counties, and we just issued a rule on Monday that greatly affected the way Hart counties do a particular operation, and I suspect that they are working on that. So it's not surprising to me that they are doing some work at their county offices today.
And they did tell me to send their regrets, but that's exactly what they're doing.
I'm not surprised by that, and it makes all the sense in the world. They've got a much more important thing coming up here in a couple weeks. So one of the things that we wanted to do with this meeting, and we'll do with the next meeting, is try to bring in other subjects which are not in the sort of mainline topic areas of the county clerks. So we're trying to find other election-related stuff because we anticipate that we will lose some county clerks in these next couple of meetings. So this particular one has some county-related functions, but basically it's a statewide issue, or in this particular case, a federal law that we at the state and other agencies in the state have to implement. And that is the National Voter Registration Act, which is called the NVRA. The NVRA is, are you going to do a history on this?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll just turn it over to Michael and he can give us all this. So I hand it over to Michael Hagahara, our presenter today.
All right. As Jed mentioned, I should give a quick overview of the NVRA. I'm going to paint broad strokes here, but generally speaking, what the NVRA requires is that states implement voter registration opportunities at the following locations. One, which most people tend to know about, is generally called motor voter, but an office where you get a driver's license, you should be able to register to vote at the same time you conduct a transaction, or if you just want to go to a driver's license office solely for the purpose of registering to vote, you should be able to do that. The second main area that the NVRA covers are called Section 7 voter registration agencies. And these are offices that generally allow people to apply for public assistance. And they also cover offices that assist people with disabilities. The most general way I think about this is that there's a segment of our population who applies for some sort of a benefit, maybe on a monthly, bi-monthly, or maybe even weekly basis. And anytime that those people are applying for a benefit, they're going to be required to fill out some forms. If they're going to be filling out forms, one of those forms needs to be what is called a declination form, or a form that says, do you want to register to vote? And if yes, then they should be given a voter registration form as well. Now, I think, admittedly, a declination form is an awful name for a form. I mean, what does it mean if you check yes in a declination form? Generally speaking, do you decline? In this case, no. It means you did not decline. So we're going to be looking at changing that name to something that makes sense. So generally, motor voter, I wanted to give you guys just a little bit of update as to what's going on that side before we move into Section 7. We updated the DMV registration form in 2011, and the form was implemented statewide in May of 2012. It was a bit of a heavy lift on CDOR's part to do this, but it ended up, I think, working out the way that we intended, and in the end, we'll give people who are registering at a driver's license office more opportunity to apply for a mail-in ballot. Here is a copy of what we refer to here and what CDOR has now adopted, as well as a tall and skinny form. If you've received a driver's license in the last probably 10 years, you recognize this as being the right half of the receipt that you receive. Most people carry that receipt around until their plastic card gets mailed to them. Prior to May of this year, the form did not include this piece on the right here, which offers people the ability to designate themselves as a permanent mail-in voter, or ask for an election-specific request, or remove themselves from a permanent mail-in voter list. We believed in our office that this is a requirement of state law, and CDOR was nice enough to work with us to get this implemented onto the form offered at their DMV offices. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, there's no way of knowing whether or not this exactly would drive up permanent mail-in voter list, especially now it's relatively easy to, once you have a driver's license, to go online and update your permanent mail-in voter status, but it's at least nice for people to have. And we believe it complies with state law, which is always a good thing. So now to move on to Section 7 agencies. Generally speaking, voter registration agencies covered in Section 7 are offices in the state that provide public assistance and all offices in the state that provide state-funded programs primarily engaged in providing services to persons with disabilities. In the first half of 2012, there are almost 23,000 people who registered for the first time at a voter registration agency. The agencies in Colorado that fall under Section 7 are really offices that answer to healthcare policy and finance, human services,
and public health and the environment. The way that the NVRA is structured is that each state has to designate a chief election official, and that person or office is responsible for coordinating the state's responsibilities under the NVRA. Now, as you'll see in this next slide, it's a bit of an odd structure in Colorado. So Colorado has designated the Secretary of State as the chief election official. Every agency that's responsible for implementing the NVRA kind of on a logistical level falls under the governor's office. So our office is responsible for making sure that these offices comply, but we really don't have a hammer to bring down upon them other than telling the governor's office, hey, can you ask them to work with us? It's kind of a strange setup, but we think that we have a pretty good relationship with the governor's office when it comes to NVRA, and so it hasn't really been a burden to this point, but it's just something that we need to keep aware of as we move forward and try to work with departments of revenue, public health and the environment, healthcare policy and finance, and human services to move forward and ensure that, you know, we're really, our goal is to lead the country in NVRA compliance, which we think we're doing, and to continue doing that, we got to have a good relationship with each of those agencies and the governor's office. You probably can't see this, I'll read this out to you, but under human services, generally speaking, social service offices and vocational rehabilitation offices work with us to register people under the NVRA. Under healthcare policy and financing, think of offices that where people can apply for medical assistance or presumptive eligibility. So presumptive eligibility generally is associated with WIC, Women, Infants, and Children Program, people who are applying for some sort of financial assistance. Medical assistance could be any of the medical services that are related with Medicare and Medicaid. Additionally, I believe that food stamps and those type of services programs fall under here. I guess that's TANF.
No.
Healthcare policy and finance, public health and the environment, CPHE, they're really pretty closely related to WIC because of the nutritional component of WIC. And then Department of Revenue, the only office that really they're concerned with there are DMV offices. So that's kind of a general overview of which offices are required to comply with the NVRA. Now, I guess I should probably go into a little bit of how the implementation works at these offices. Our office provides training online that the, you can call them examiners, or in some cases probably nurses, or just staff level employees at these offices are seeing people come in. We provide training that they can view and review to understand how voter registration needs to be offered to people. Generally speaking, if they're getting forms, one of those forms needs to be a voter registration form. The way we do in Colorado is we color that NVRA form green. It's generally speaking the same voter registration form, just a different color. The reason it's a different color is so that way when it's received at a county clerk recorder's office, it can be entered into the statewide voter registration system with a specific transaction code. Now that helps us to track how we're doing with NVRA, and that's where that 23,000 number came from, is we looked at, okay, who registered for the first time and has an NVRA transaction source associated with their name. Now, it's not a perfect way of tracking forms. There's a couple reasons why it's not a perfect way of tracking. One is there's always the possibility that data can get entered incorrectly because the counties right now are facing a huge volume of voter registration forms. And if you key in one thing incorrectly, you know, out of 1,000 or 10,000, I mean, it's a pretty acceptable error rate, I would say. Additionally, it could be that an individual goes to an NVRA agency and takes that form and doesn't actually complete it, but maybe goes online and registers. Well, we don't know when someone registers online that that transaction actually stemmed from an interaction at an NVRA agency, and whether or not we should really care. I mean, the ultimate goal is to get registered, and that's, you know, what's happening. But from a tracking standpoint, it can skew things a little bit. So, for example, if you were to ask us, okay, what is the number of declination, or I want to call them voter choice forms, that, you know, were reported to you and the number of registrations are reported to you, they're not always going to match up because of the fact that maybe someone doesn't have their driver's license on them, knows they have a driver's license number, and wants to take the form home and register there. So there's a lot of different scenarios that play out. But one of the things that we tried to look at this last year was, can we compare in a general sense, the number of declination or voter choice forms are reported to our office and the number of NVRA transaction source documents in the statewide voter registration database. And for those of you listening, I apologize for this, but there is a chart on the whiteboard down here that's going to show some of the data that we pulled from that. Now, this is going to be, it's not gospel by any means. And in fact, the data is probably somewhat flawed because of those issues I just pointed out about the declination forms not matching up. But it gives us a general sense. On the left, you'll probably too far away, but if you go up there, you'll see different office locations, and those line graphs there show their compliance rate going across the past 15 months.
And that's in getting us data.
In getting us the data, oh. Yeah. And so that's in their reporting compliance. And that's really kind of what this picture back here is going to show us. It gives an idea of, okay, which offices do we need to start working with more to figure out, okay, why aren't you reporting, or are you reporting maybe just the wrong place? What kind of education and opportunities are out there? In the middle part of that is just in the same information represented a little bit differently with the, I guess it's a, what would you call that?
I don't remember.
The percentage
bar. The percentage bars.
Yeah, right. Going across. The middle, there's a map showing what you could generally say is reporting compliance by county, color-coded. And then as you move
across all of the agencies.
Across all the agencies.
So like the red counties are the counties that are not doing very well across all of the agencies in terms of reporting. And then the yellow counties are, you know, doing okay. And the green counties are doing very well. So there's not much of a pattern there, but it looks like the Eastern Plains does the least well in reporting.
As you go to the far right, there's going to be a graphical representation of the, I think there's going to be orange and green counties, and the orange counties are going to be counties where it looked like the NVRA agencies reported more choice forms than registrations in SCORE. Now, there's a lot of reasons why this data should not be relied on as being absolute. The majority being that, let's say I live in Prowers County, and I mail a packet for benefits into a processing center in Denver. Well, that declination form is going to get reported as being coming from Denver, so it looks like Denver registered a person. And so we don't really have a way of tracking by county. We could always ask these offices to start doing more, but then again, it's hard for us to tell them what to do because of that reporting structure, and we don't want to push them so far they say, we don't want to do this at all. And so it's kind of, and that's what we'll hopefully have a discussion about here in a minute. I promise I'll only talk at y'all for 5 more minutes, then we'll actually have a discussion here. But so that's essentially what that represents, and feel free to get up anytime and look at it if you'd like. So there's 3 areas that, before we discuss, I just kind of wanted to let you all know that we're thinking about focusing on for improvement. The 3 areas are, we want to be able to identify who are the voter registration agencies in Colorado that need to be conducting NVRA activities. We want to train, and we are currently training, but we always want to figure out how we can train better. And we also want to figure out, are there better ways to track how compliant we are with the NVRA? So from the identify standpoint, I think I just lost my mouse. All right. Luckily, I printed it out as well, so...
Can you go down?
I have no idea. Yeah. Maybe we need a new computer. So from identify, what we just need to really do is figure out, all right, who falls under the umbrella of the NVRA? For example, if you're a community health center that's not a governmental agency, are you still required to comply with the NVRA? There's a case out of the Second Circuit in New York that suggests no, but at the same point, is that a good decision? I mean, there's always the opportunity to question. Additionally, the NVRA states that the chief election official shall designate voter registration agencies. We currently don't have a formal designation process. Is that something we should consider? And then on the training side, we're working with stakeholders to increase awareness about our online training. We've recently realized that some of them may not know that our website exists, let alone the training on our website. Additionally, we want all of these state agencies to rely on our training and solely our training because of the fact that if you have multiple trainings, if form gets updated, and only the training will update on our website. You have an old training that's still being circulated throughout healthcare policy and finance, for example. Additionally, this last we're still in August. A couple weeks ago, we brought in the four agencies for a process map training in our office to try and help them figure out ways to streamline their internal processes. We're going to be following up with them in September to create some to-be process maps they can hopefully implement. And also, really, one of the reasons we did this is to create better relationships with these agencies. Because, again, we have an odd reporting structure in Colorado.
Mike, can I have a question?
Sure.
So when you say four agencies, are you talking about the four departments that
yes.
you... Because for me, as a former state employee, when you say agency, that's not a department. That's a office or a division within the department. So you're...
If I say four, I'm referencing a department, but I will work on specifying that going forward.
Thank you.
It's also kind of a tricky... thing because the MVRA calls it agencies, even though in this particular way we're talking about departments that have agencies that do the work. So it's just a tricky language barrier.
Thank you.
And
yes.
Can I ask, how unusual is Colorado in this structure?
My guess is that we're not unusual.
Yeah,
it's just
is
that
right? Okay.
I mean, the law is... At this point, it's an older law that was created before the internet, and so it was probably created at exactly the wrong time. I mean, the idea of instituting a law that relies heavily on paper in the early 90s, it's you're just behind the curve a little bit there. So, and there was a lot of restructuring, I think, with elections divisions in different states with HAVA and especially just after 2000.
And actually, so we're one of about 42 states or so, I think it's 41, 42, 43, something like that, who have a Secretary of State. There are a number of states that don't have Secretaries of State. And our state has an elected Secretary of State that does elections. So that's why we've inherited this particular regulatory function. There are other states that have the elections oversight process all within the governor or lieutenant governor's office, because often in the states that don't have a Secretary of State, the lieutenant governor has that power. So under that scenario, this would be a very easy process. They would tell their lieutenants, you need to be doing this. If you're not doing it, you're going to be in trouble. We're not in that position as easily where we can dictate to these agencies or departments things that they need or should be doing. Fortunately, as Michael alluded to, we have a very good relationship with the governor's office, and the governor's office takes this very seriously. So we can go to the governor's office and say, hey, for whatever reason, we're having trouble connecting up with this person or that person, and get a lot of assistance in that process. What's good about that is that I think we all sort of see this as a common good that we should be all working toward, and there's no sort of partisan element to this. The Secretary takes our compliance on MVRA incredibly seriously. I'll say that this is a much bigger topic than it was under the previous administration, which was a Democratic administration. So anybody who links MVRA compliance to partisanship has probably missed the boat on that, at least as it relates to the last couple of secretaries in Colorado. And the governor's office has taken this very seriously as well, because they're taking lead on maybe making the proper connections for us to be able to work directly with the agencies that actually do the work. So it's so far been a great working relationship across the different parts of our state government.
And so the last area that we're looking at improving is how we can track our compliance. We're going to be creating an MVRA working group with individuals from each of the four departments to ask them, what would work at the staff level? Because we don't want to create requirements that are too onerous and really burden. I mean, their main job there is to provide public assistance, not to offer voter registration. Now, maybe one would say those are one and the same, but convincing them of that, you know, will take some work. Additionally, we need to find better metrics and tools to track the progress of voter registration agencies in Colorado. Like I said, it'd be great if I could tell you that the stats you're going to see on that board back there can be relied on as truth, but they frankly can't. And so we need to get to that point. And how we do that probably ends up being a result of how much time and money we have to put towards a problem like that. I mean, the idea, if you could barcode every single form that went out and track it and figure out where it came from, where it went, that'd be great. But is it really worth spending that much time and money on something like that? So answer is probably somewhere between what we currently have and that. It's in the middle. And then the final point I just want to mention is that we are going to be asking for an attorney general opinion with regards to a couple different things about whether or not we should be formally designating voter registration agencies. You know, and then how would that, what would that look like? Would it be done at a department level who tells us the offices that should be designated under them and then we formally designate, or would it be our office literally, you know, hitting the road and figuring out who should be designated? Additionally, we need to figure out in Colorado whether or not the NVRA applies to non-governmental offices that offer public assistance. This Second Circuit case, for anyone who cares, the site is 202 Federal 3rd, 110, and it's 2000. It's Disabled in Action Metro New York versus Hammons, H-A-M-M-O-N-S. And if we can get screen back up for those in the room, it'll be up there. But we want some guidance from our Attorney General. And I think that one of the things after, you know, comments that are made today will help us to figure out what should that, you know, request for an AGO look like.
One of the big questions that flows from that last one is that many of these departments and agencies that are supposed to be doing this work, because of the evolving nature of the way these work, these agencies work, they are now hiring vendors to do the functions of the state government. So if you approach an agency and you say to them, hey, we think that you and all of your vendors need to be doing this, they'll go, yeah, that's probably right. But if you approach the vendor, 9 times out of 10, the vendor will say, well, it doesn't apply to private industry, it only applies to public. So why are we getting roped in on this? You know, we know of a couple, because we've worked with them, who are trying to, you know, plug this into their existing process. I think some are reluctant to take that leap because they don't really see it as their mission. You know, their mission is to do those things which they've been asked to do contractually. So one way we're kind of trying to get around that is go to the agencies and say, look, if you hire a vendor, you need to put in the contract that they have to do this. So that's another kind of part of this that we're going through as well.
Yeah.
Question, Joe Ritchie, how many of these sort of outfits are there that are providing services that the state normally provides? Is it a big job to getting to all of those vendors, or how many are we talking about?
You know, I think that it's the one that comes to mind is with regards to medical offices that offer medical assistance. They use vendors through HCPUF located in Denver, and Healthcare Policy and Finance, sorry if I use the acronym HCPUF, is really pushing hard on them, these vendors that they use, to report their NVRA numbers. Now, part of the problem that comes up is somebody will call up and say, you know, oh, I need to renew these, this public benefit, I changed my address, how do I do so? Well, that's really an interaction, and how do you get them a voter registration form through the phone? You know, can you tell them, go to GoVote Colorado and make sure you update your address there as well? Is that considered to be compliant with the NVRA? I mean, the end result is good if they do it, but you're not giving them a voter registration form in person. You could mail one to them. And so the only vendor I'm really aware of, or vendors, are through the medical assistance program that's governed by Healthcare Policy and Finance, or certified, I should say, by Healthcare Policy and Finance. Are there
Maximus is the
that's
biggest,
the one I'm,
biggest one.
Yeah, they do a ton of volume for them.
This is Faith. Does Maximus do the single entry points? The single entry points is where people go to actually apply for Medicaid. Medicaid is a program of healthcare policy and finance.
I think that's right. My understanding, but you've gotten well out of my field of expertise. So
they are an option for that. There's others apart from them, but they do offer that entry point.
Is this the time for me to jump in?
Absolutely. Sure. You've jumped in with both feet.
This is Faith again. And I wish we could, if we can get back to that organizational chart.
I think we've got a much bigger problem. Yeah.
I'm going to stop broadcasting if I can get this.
Stop broadcasting. I think we stopped that about 10 or 15 minutes ago. So you guys can say
so please
whatever you want.
Oh, that's very dangerous.
You can cuss up a storm.
Seven
right
dirty
now.
Words, here they come.
Well, maybe we're starting back up. Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So,
we'll get it back up.
Yeah, when I looked at that, and I should share with you all that I was a state employee for 20 years, and I was a vocational rehabilitation counselor. And I worked with, and that was the one agency that was listed up there, DVR. And I can tell you that DVR was not offering voter registration until I met with them when I started the voting program in 2004 and said, you have to do this. And their first response to me was, no, we don't. And my, yes, you do. When they researched it, they came back and said, you were right. And so they did start to do this, start to offer voter registration. But the number of people that are served each year by DVR, vocational rehabilitation, is a small percentage of people with disabilities in Colorado. To people who go to DVR are people with disabilities who want to go to work or maintain work. So a very small percentage. The Department of Human Services contracts out mental health services, with the exception of the state institutions, Fort Logan and in Pueblo. And they contract out all the mental health services to the community behavioral health services offices or systems around the state. They contract out all of the developmental disability services except for the two very small regional centers, one in Pueblo and one in Grand Junction. So the State Department of Human Services is providing very little direct services to people with disabilities in Colorado. I have had the position for 8 years now that those contractors, so the behavioral health offices or service providers, the community center boards, and the service providers that they contract with should all be designated NVRA agencies, even though they're in their private nonprofits. But they are receiving state funds as well as federal funds to provide direct services to people with disabilities. And I believe that that was the intent of that provision in NVRA. Because these are often folks who, at least until recently, may not have needed a state photo ID and so didn't go to motor vehicles offices to get that. And so they had to be offered this service somewhere, and so it was these other state agencies. Colorado in the 90s, in the mid-90s, did a major restructuring of social services and human services in Colorado. That's when healthcare policy and finance was created. There used to be a separate just Medicaid agency. There used to be the Department of Human Social Services and the Department of Institutions. So when that, and I think that this all kind of fell to the side when that restructuring occurred, and probably was not even on anybody's radar. How are we going to comply with MDRA? So the bottom line for me is that there is a huge number of people with disabilities who do get services, but are getting them from community-based organizations, not directly from the state. And those folks are not being, for the most part, are not being offered voter registration. When I'm out in the disability community statewide meeting with folks from these different organizations and we're talking about voter registration, I'm telling them, one, you can, what their options are. So one option would be to just have one person on staff offering voter registration to folks without being a designated agency, without being a VR, they don't then fall into the VRD area, because if we limit it to one staff person. But once, then when I explain to them, if it's more than one staff person, then you're either have to become a VRD, voter registration drive, or you could find out about becoming an NVRA designated agency. When I tell them the requirements and potential penalties and fines for being a VRD, they get scared and don't want anything to do with it. I'm a VRD and I understand that fully. And then the whole issue with being an NVRA agency is that paperwork, that whole, you know, just the bureaucracy piece of it. But the bottom line is that there are thousands of people with disabilities in Colorado who are not being offered voter registration as mandated, as I see the mandate under NVRA. And it's a big issue.
Do you think online registration has changed that dynamic a little bit?
Well, online registration, if you don't have your
point of updating
your, if you don't have a driver's license number or a state ID number, you cannot get into the system. And by the way the system is set up right now, if you don't, even once you're registered to vote, you can't, if you don't have those numbers, you can't go online and make any changes to your registration or even activate your registration, which, by the way, I don't think that was how the statute was written. But that's probably another, that's another subject.
Which statute?
No, I think what Faye's referencing is that
registration statute.
I do believe we would need a statutory change to give our office the ability to roll out OLVR to more people, because we're relying on an electronic signature from the Department of Revenue. If the statute would allow us to allow to rely on an electronic signature from our database, because of the mail ballot elections we've had recently and the amount of scanned signatures, we could roll it out to a much wider population. But I and this is just my off the top of my head, I think we would need a statutory change to do that. But maybe that's something that this commission could recommend, because we do have a lot more signature images now than we did 4 years ago.
But you still need the signature, but we've got it. We've just got it from a different source. We got it in person.
Right. And that was my understanding when the bill was being heard at the legislature and when it passed, was that if you were already registered to vote, your signature was in the in a system, in SCORE, right?
Not for everyone, because it was it 07 or 08? When did the OLVR bill pass? Oh, was it 09 maybe?
2009.
Is it 9?
9 for 10, because we had like 6 months to get it up.
Yeah. There were a lot of signatures in SCORE, but there weren't.
Yeah, but the other thing is that the way the, I think you're right, the way the bill is written or the way the law is now, it says we have to use the signature, that you can't use it unless there's a signature on file at the DMV. That's what it says. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to use that signature, because that signature is going to get replaced, because Pam's people are going to, every time they get a new signature, they're going to put in the new signature. But to get in originally, be able to transact, we've got to have a file on, or you've got to have a signature on file at the DMV, which is, I think, not what they intended. Because if the intent is that you have a signature that somebody has verified, well, we verified it because we went through a process of the, on the election side that verified it. So
I'll tell you, if you could, if there was some way for these, for folks applying for services from these community-based agencies to actually register online, even without an ID number, because for the mental health services, developmental disability services, those are in-person applications. Those are not, the Medicaid applications might be, I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm not familiar with how that works, but I do know that for developmental disability services and mental health services, that is an in-person intake. And that person could, you could actually just register them online right there, like they do at motor vehicles. The difference being that the person may not have a motor vehicles or a Department of Revenue number, like you have it.
You have to build in an exception to the law that says that if the online voter registration application was done in front of a state officer at an official state, you know, office. But then you've got the problem of the first time you send them a ballot, you're going to send them a ballot demanding that they give you a license or something that has their signature on it, or they can't vote it. So then you've got the secondary problem. Then you create a secondary problem, unless they vote in person.
What about the application form that they sign at the service delivery?
We just don't have any way to get that signature into our file. How do we get that signature to our file?
I think that your main point then is just basically it needs to be easier. Yeah. It needs to be an easier way. This is going to be out there in left field, but what is your just initial reaction to the idea that what if they didn't have to report anything to us? What if they kept their forms in-house and they only need to keep them for auditing purposes, and so all they had to do was offer voter registration? What if we didn't require them to report their voter choice or declination numbers each month? Do you think that they'd be more receptive to the idea of offering it?
Definitely. There's no doubt in my mind.
I know that's not the question that wants...
I think that might take a change in them.
Yeah, but to think about the options, is that what's keeping organizations from wanting to comply is the reporting element? Yeah. So
I should say this here, but that's the conversation we had in our office about becoming at the legal center, about becoming a MVRA agency. Was too much, you know, we already have too much paperwork. That was more paperwork and more reporting and burdensome.
You became a VRD.
Well, I'm a VRD because under HAVA, my program, which is authorized under HAVA, we're mandated to do voter registration. So I've been a voter registration drive since that law went into effect. But this was to get my coworkers to be doing voter registration.
Just to expand the discussion just a bit to another function of the sort of various governmental or governor's departments that we believe are covered by MVRA. We were having discussions in the lead up to this process mapping that we did with all the agencies that Michael was talking about. I was talking to person at DHS, and I just asked him to think about all of the services that you provide to individuals. So individuals that come in your doors or go on your website and have an interaction with you, where they walk away with something tangible, a service of some type, and like click those off for me. And he started talking about the various things that they do, and I was going, okay, we do that one, we do that one. And I got about three into this, and I went, wait a minute. And I started writing these down, and one of the ones that he mentioned was youth corrections. And I thought, youth corrections, that's odd. I mean, you do realize that you have to be 18 years of age to vote, right? And he went, oh yeah, we've got lots of people in youth corrections that are over the age of 18. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting, but they're in corrections. Are they in for felonies? Well, some of them are in for felonies, but many of them are not in for felonies. So there's this chunk of people that are in youth corrections that are age eligible and haven't committed a felony that would be able to vote. And we're not reaching out to those people as well. So there's these little pockets of activity that are happening in state government that we're unaware of.
This is Faith again, if I could just address that. I would say that there's probably a sizable percentage of the folks who are in youth corrections who are, in fact, people with disabilities, learning disabilities, mental health issues, attention deficit disorder, very common,
yep.
Very high percentage. But youth corrections is not a a state agency that is primarily engaged in providing services to people with disabilities, nor is it a public assistance agency. So I would make the case that Youth Corrections is not targeted agency.
That gets to your definition of services. So, I mean, if you house somebody and they live there and, you know, they get their meals and they get their bunk, and, well, is that a service you're providing? Or are they incarcerated? Or some other definite or other word that sort of means service. Like that.
No.
You know, is that a service?
Forced service.
So again, that's, and we don't have a lot of direction from the federal courts on this. DOJ is always cagey about stuff. So if you go to DOJ, it's always a great conversation when you go to DOJ. You say, hey, DOJ, we got this kind of conundrum on this issue. What should we be doing? Is this something we should, and they go, you know, you should do what's right, and we'll be checking in on you now, because we're now aware of the fact that
they say, don't forget, they're the cops you're asking.
That's what they say, you're asking
reinforcement.
Yeah, so and then the federal courts, there have been a number of cases, but honestly the cases tend to fly right down the middle. They don't tend to go, they're like not on the edge of the fairway, they're not in the rough, they're right down the middle. And so you have a state that's woefully out of compliance, where it's pretty easy. The court says, well, you're not doing this, and you're not doing this, and you're not doing this. And they basically carve out a plan, which is the four corners of what we know the normal implementation of MVRA would be. And they, you know, hand it to the state, and the state goes and does it. But we don't have these weird ones on the edges. We don't have a lot with private vendors. We don't have a lot with these agencies which may or may not be in the service distribution area. We also have this new phenomenon, which is really starting to become an issue for us, which is that the agencies are providing more and more of their services online. So if you're getting a service through an online connection to your client, don't you also need to, at that moment, provide an opportunity to register to vote? Well, look, Colorado is one of those great states that has an online opportunity, OLVR, Oliver, as Pam likes to call it. We have Oliver in the state. And so
we should.
I, you're the only one that I've heard do it.
I'll start doing it. I like it.
It's cute.
It is cute.
I mean, that's hard too because of the conversation we had earlier about the driver's license or state ID number being required. So it works out really well for Department of Revenue. They say if you're renewing your driver's license online, here's a link to
GoVoteCar.com. Well, that's sort of my comment. Before we say it works really well for Department of Revenue, I was curious if you had heard about the research grant funded from Pew regarding motor voter, and there's a report. Coming out,
there's
this
a report
man.
Coming out, yes.
So,
we're aware of that. They've been
so there's a report coming out about the effectiveness, and I'm actually not sure what it's going to be about yet. I haven't seen a preview. I anticipate getting one relatively soon.
That's what they say.
But so my perspective from the one receiving forms, you know, is before expanding, should we get good at what we're doing regarding training agencies? Because what we see, you know, is without good training, without good compliance, without good, you know, outreach, which you guys are doing, and seeing that benefit from it before expanding and either, you know, having just huge non-compliance and no bandwidth to be able to do it. I mean, I think the community, you know, foundations arena is a great place to go for folks, but we want to make sure we have the infrastructure in place to assist them to do it well, because if we get incomplete or form 6 months late,
or a year and a half late,
right? That is more problematic than not offering at all when you have Oliver.
Yep.
If someone submits a form or signs a form thinking they're getting registered, right, because it's a paper-based form and there's some sort of bureaucratic process versus going to a more efficient process. And then, you know, they become ineligible as a result. for an election they expected to get a ballot for. You know, unless they can say, well, I got this agency and I'm doing a provisional, but that's more of a barrier to registration, in my opinion, you know, than doing it well here and then expanding. You know, from, you know, if the agency is going to be responsible for getting that.
No, and one thing that so we're talking about all of the complications of doing this well, and we as a state are trying to delve into the various levels of what we feel like we need to do to be the most compliant state that we can be, and try to be a model for other states. But in having that conversation, ironically, having that conversation exposes you to potential criticism for the fact that you're not already doing those things, or you're not going as deep as you could, or there's maybe another layer that you're failing to get to. Because of the job I have, and because of the constituency that I have to be beholden to, I would just note that according to a couple of major studies by the people who do the enforcement actions against states when they fail to do this stuff properly, Colorado is one of the very best states in the country with regard to this work. We're already a model, and we're a model. Faith is shaking her head at us.
Oh, it's pathetic.
We're a model, right, that demonstrates...
It's relative.
We are a model that demonstrates that how bad other states must be, because we take a look at this and go, gosh, we could do so much better if we did this, and what if we got down to that, and what, and yet when I go to national conferences, people come up to me and go, how do you guys do so well with MVRA? And I think, oh my God, why are you asking me that question? I mean, we're spending hours and hours and hours trying to figure out how we can do better. And they're, of course, not even in that mode yet. They're like, way down the road from that. And here, let me give you a great example. Project Vote recently, in the last 6-8 months, released a listing, a ranking of all of the states with regard to MVRA Section 7 compliance. So it's not motor voter, but it's Section 7. It's all the agencies. Project Vote listed all of the states. We were tied for 4th, 5th, and 6th. Right? On the list. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, so if you put us at number 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 were all in consent decrees with Department of Justice or Project Vote or some other agency, other nonprofit. We were the first state that wasn't in a consent decree, which means we're the first state that it didn't require legal action to get us into the top 5. We got there voluntarily. Right? And actually, to be perfectly honest, we got there at the, you know, at the bayonet of, you know, the point of the bayonet, because a couple of years ago, Project Vote was coming to us going, you're next, you're next. And we got our act together and managed to get back into good compliance with them. And now we're, you know, kind of a showcase state for them. You know, here's what you can do if you get your act together, you can be like Colorado.
Just curious, who's at the bottom of the barrel in the
You know, honestly, I'd have to go look. I didn't look below 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Those are the only ones I was worried about.
Project Vote site will have.
I know who number 1 is. Number 1 is Ohio. And interestingly, Ohio has been sued not once but twice. And the second one was by DOJ. So they got sued by somebody, Project Vote or somebody, Brendan Center. And then... they lost, got, you know, slapped down by a federal judge, and 2 years later, after they still didn't do what the federal judge said, DOJ came in and said, no, you're going to do this, and they got into a consent decree with DOJ, and they ended up being, you know, the best state in the country. Well, of course they're the best state in the country, you know, they had a federal judge, DOJ, throwing the book at them. But the low states tended to be states in the old South. They tend to struggle in these kinds of areas. But honestly, I didn't really look closely. So.
Well,
Right.
So, again, so can, let's go back to the, let's just, if we could, talk about the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
So the Department of Human Services, in addition to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, operates the two regional centers, one in Grand Junction, which I think is down to fewer than 100 beds, and in Pueblo, also pretty small. Most of the folks who in the past were housed at these regional, large regional centers have been moved out into the community and are now receiving services through the community center boards, which are, again, private nonprofits. I'm more concerned about Fort Logan, the Colorado Mental Health Institute of Fort Logan and in Pueblo. Now, I will tell you that every federal election year, the patient advocate at Fort Logan calls me and says, would you please come out and talk to folks about voting and offer voter registration? And in fact, I'm going there next Tuesday. So, and I will be offering voter registration and talking about the importance of voting and civic engagement.
Are you taking Lisa with you? Is Lisa going?
No.
We should. You should go out and you can do some ADA stuff while you're at there.
Thursday?
No, Tuesday evening. Next Tuesday evening, we can
we'll,
talk.
Yeah, we'll
but
often these two are going around the state all the time doing ADA compliance.
Thelma and Louise.
They're Thelma and Louise.
Thelma and Louise. I like that. I like that.
That's a little scary.
But at any rate, in the patient, I forget what her exact title is, but she's terrific, the patient advocate there. And in fact, I have worked with her in a couple of, again, federal election years to get emergency ballots for folks who thought they would be able to go to a polling place on election day and then for whatever reason were hospitalized and unable to leave the hospital. And so she's terrific. But personally, I believe that they should be offering, they're a state agency, everybody that comes through their door is somebody with a disability, and they should be routinely offering voter registration, and apparently they're not, because they asked me to come in and do it. Now, when somebody's being admitted to the state mental health institution, it's probably not the best time to offer that person voter registration. But when that person is being discharged, it should be a standard part of their planning to transition back to the community. Right?
Makes sense to me.
So that's the state hospitals. Then if we move over to developmental disabilities, so those are community center boards, and I forget how many, but off the top of my head, there's about 25. Don't hold me to that number, but there's a lot of them all over the state. And then most of those community center boards, certainly the larger ones in the, you know, metro area and El Paso County, probably Pueblo County, they then purchase services or contract out services to community-based service providers. They used to be called approved service agencies. And so I think that when the person is determined eligible for services through the community center board, they should, that voter registration offer for everybody who's 18 and a citizen should be offered routinely. It should be incorporated into that intake process. Again, these are private sector nonprofits, but their funding is almost entirely public funding, federal funding, state funding, and the community center boards also, many of them have get local taxes. Or county taxes. But I do believe that those are the type of agencies that were intended to be covered under NVRA. And it's that provision of NVRA where it says in other agencies, other designated agencies, I think it is, that primarily provide services to individuals with disabilities.
I think it's 7C. And the C, because there's A and B, which are really obvious, and then C is sort of the catch-all, which makes things more complicated, because I think under some states they have a very hierarchical, you know, state government, and everything is in one box, and so this tends to be a pretty easy process where we have dispersed a lot of these roles into county or even sort of municipal agencies, or handed them off to private or community-based organizations, it becomes much more complicated. Sean?
Well, I'd just like to suggest, too, that maybe in addition to working with the agencies and departments, too, we could work with the like Colorado Winds, which represents the state workers that worked at Fort Morgan and Pueblo, and work through the different employee organizations to work this as well. It's just another avenue.
One of the ways that we've tried to tackle it so far was through this process mapping. And we brought in, it was one person, we had teams of three. So we had six teams of three. And on each team, we had one person from the Department of State. So Michael was on a team, I was on a team, Lisa was on a team, and a couple of other people, Christy Heppard, who you all, Chris McKelvin now, but you probably all know her. We had a person on each of these teams to sort of help them think about the election side of it, and then they were process mapping how they currently go from a form arrives in the mail to a form goes out in the mail, you know, or a form goes to Pam at Jefferson County, and they were supposed to tell us what happens in between point A and point Z. Those conversations, I thought, were very productive because, first of all, I think they started to see us not as these guys that are constantly hounding them for numbers, but as like real people who are trying to achieve a real goal for them, you know. And that, in fact, their goal and our goals were very tied, very similar, because at one point, very early on, somebody said, I'm having difficulty seeing how this connects to the work that we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And I said, well, how's your funding doing? And she said, oh, well, we're just getting slashed. And I said, and why do you think that is? And she went, well, because the, you know, state government, they're pulling the plug on everything. And I said, and why do you think that is? And it could it be because the people that are getting these services are not voting, and thus the people that they would be voting for are not in those offices, and hence they're not making policies which are affecting those populations. I mean, it's a natural one plus one plus one. It's really pretty easy when you get there. And
except in states that have Tabor.
Tabor does complicate things to some degree. But it's true that if you lay out how these things all work together, they become much more interested in that larger engagement. And so we had great conversations with the agency personnel, who I think really walked out of there believing that we had a common purpose, and had great ideas for how to streamline their process and improve their interactions, and you know, provide us better data. Because what that is an illustration of the fact that we're not getting great data. Mm-hmm. You know, even our best agency, our top agency, is only giving us data about 80% of the time. So we have these numbers where we say 23,000 people have done something this year. That's 23,000 people of what we can measure, you know, what we have available to us. So it's really, you know, connecting all those dots, which will allow us to have, you know, a better insight into the work that they do, and then ultimately be able to use that information to improve the work that they do. So it's all a big circle, and we have to start at some point on that circle to get around to the other side. So
is this a case where the governor's office could require that any contract renewals have additional language that make this a requirement? Would that be the way that this would trickle down, phasing it in as each independent, what are they called, approved service provider?
You know, it's certainly possible. I think the only concern with that would be that the governor's office doesn't tell us what to do. You know, so we do our own contracts. Mm-hmm. And we have parameters from, I don't think it's from the governor's office, from the controller. Yeah. But, you know, they give us parameters on things we can and can't do. So I don't know how much the long arm of state government, you know, reaches down into those agency decisions, but.
I think it could, though, because that's essentially the model that's used with regards to certifying medical assistants and presumptive eligibility sites, is that you check a box saying, I will comply with the, or my organization will comply with the MVRA. Problem is what happens when they don't? Do you strip away the presumptive eligibility, and then who? Are you kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face at that point?
You can't be an MVRA agency.
Yeah, you have to kick all the people out of the beds in your hospital now because you violated this part of your contract, and whether or not that's like the best way to go forward is, you know, a discussion for the governor's office. But I think the main tool that we're going to use going forward in the short run is this attorney general opinion that we're going to request. Those can take a while, but the information that Faith you put out here today, I think, really helps us with craft. I'm glad we haven't crafted it yet, because I hadn't thought about the idea that there are community organizations assisting people with disabilities that are state funded. Do you by chance know if there's an office at state level that could tell us how state funds get dispersed to organizations that serve people with disabilities? If we could track the money to the office, then we'd have a list of organizations to speak with.
I'm sure there is. I mean, but it may be that you'd have to go to the Office of Behavioral Health. You'd have to go to the Office of Developmental and Intellectual Disabilities. You know, the Office of Aging and Adult Services. I mean, I would think if you started at the executive director's level, they would, you know, mm-hmm. get you to the right people. But certainly, I mean, they have to, you know, they have to be accountable. They have to track those contracts. There's an Office of Procurement, probably very similar to the Department of State. You know, the structure is probably very similar to your department. So I'm sure there is, and I'd be happy to work with you.
Yeah, I mean, because I kind of ran up the flagpole at Healthcare Policy and Financing, thinking that was the right flagpole to go after. But I don't. It sounds like Human Services may be the better place to start that discussion.
Well, healthcare policy and finance is they're that's again Medicaid. So they're but they contract that out to the single entry points and other. You know, I don't think it's so much department staff who are providing those direct services. Mm-hmm. I think they're more doing administrative functions. But I could be wrong because I don't know that department as well as I know Human Services.
Yeah.
But that's my sense, is the people don't go to HCPF to apply for Medicaid. They go to these entities yep. That are community-based
yep.
to apply for Medicaid.
And they may never have a contact with an actual HCPF office.
That's correct.
And so because of that, they never get an opportunity to register them, other than the opportunities which exist to everyone every day. But, you know, that's not what the MVRA is designed to do.
And that was the point I made at the beginning of my part of this conversation. There's a huge number, it's a very small percentage of people with disabilities in Colorado who are actually directly interacting with the state agency, even though the funding for the services that they're receiving in the community is, oftentimes it's federal funding that flows through the state. And I haven't even mentioned the 10 independent living centers around the state, but they are all the federal money that goes to them. Some of it flows through the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, but they're all private, nonprofit, community-based agencies. But they cover the entire state. The 10 centers cover the entire state, and they're not. None of them are MVRA designated agencies.
I'm gonna have to go when we're done. I'm gonna have to go back and review this conversation. Fortunately, I know now where it's being taped, so that we can try to remember all this. Let me talk to you about one other part of this, which is slightly different than what we previously discussed, and that is that in 2010 there was a district court decision in New York State, and it's in the case of U.S. v. SUNY CUNY. And if you guys know what SUNY CUNY is, it's the State University of New York and the City University of New York. It's also If you go further down the list of defendants, it includes all the community colleges in the state of New York. So all of the state-funded two-year colleges as well. So it's the state-funded statewide universities, the state-funded city universities in New York State. So DOJ sued them because they believe that under a strict reading of the NBRA, those universities that provided services for those persons with disabilities should be offering them an opportunity to register to vote at each one of those interactions. So the way New York State had set up each one of their university campuses was that they had an office called, and in fact I wrote this down, they called it the Disabled Student Services Office. So each university had one of these offices. And because they had one of those offices, and because students came into those offices and sought services, DOJ said, those are NVRA agencies, and they must do voter registration. The state of New York, as is often the case with DOJ, the New York and the DOJ, not real big fans of one another, interestingly, considering that, you know, they're right there and, you know, probably have a lot of overlap in the people that work for one and the other. But they got sued by DOJ, and in fact, I've talked to the New York people, and they never really seriously considered doing something or agreeing with them or trying to do it before the lawsuit. They just said, sure, bring it on, and they got sued. So the university systems in the state got sued, and the two ended up, the SUNY CUNY lost in summary judgment. So they didn't even make it to trial. They lost before they ever got to trial. And that led to a consent decree with DOJ. So DOJ loves to do that. They love to win an early win and then swoop in and say, okay, just sign here. You know, just sign here. It'll all be over if you just sign here. And that's what they did. And the consent decree lists out a whole bunch of elements. And it basically said that New York had to name campuses as NBRA sites. By the way, one of the early things that Michael said, or sort of alluded to, was that that we in the state of Colorado don't actually designate sites. We have no list of designated sites. We should probably do that. And I'm guessing that that'll be something the AG's office will tell us when we ask them.
I hope so.
You know, and that will lead us down that road of we're going to try to figure out where that line is, which is always a very difficult thing for us to do. And then each site that then had to have a designated person who was their NBRA agent at the site. All persons needed to be offered services or that were renewing services had to be offered an opportunity to register. All persons offered must also be assisted to complete the form. Now, this was a completely new thing that was in this consent decree that New York signed, which effectively created law in the Second Circuit, which was very interesting because that's not in the NBRA. The NBRA does not say that you have to assist the person to do the form. Doesn't say that. I like that eyebrow though, that's good.
One federal law does mandate that.
It doesn't in the NBRA. It doesn't say that they have to assist them. Like, and the idea of that is through like verbal or physical assistance, like to fill out the form and stuff. And that's not in the NBRA. It perhaps should be in the NBRA, but it's not in the NBRA. So it's, but it was in the consent decree. And then they had to post notices. So they had to put notices around. They had to do trainings at all their campuses and they had to gather and maintain statistics. So there were all these elements to it. But one of the really interesting things that's in the consent decree is this really broad language that says that basically every state or state-run entity that offers services to persons with disabilities must abide by the NBRA. So they had this really blanket coverage of state-run or not state-run So they put that in there. So New York State is probably covered under a much stricter analysis of NVRA compliance than Colorado or any other state who has not been sued, gone through this, is. So anyway, there's this SUNY CUNY. What we've tried to do in the state of Colorado, and we believe that we're the only state in the country that's done this. We have no other examples of other states that are doing this. When I, again, I go to these conferences, people do not talk about this. We have taken the SUNY CUNY case and tried to apply it to Colorado. So we've identified all of the state universities and community colleges that we believe fall under the rubric of this definition. And we've asked them all to be NVRA agencies. Some of them, a handful said, all right. And then several of them are kicking and screaming as we drag them in. It's just basically they feel overwhelmed by all the stuff that they have to do as it is, and they're trying to figure out, well, where are we going to plug this? This doesn't fit in nicely into our system, perhaps like it did in New York, or I don't know. But anyway, the common refrain is, well, we have a person that only works half time anyway. I mean, they're not even here all the time. And we go, well, sorry. So we've done meetings with them. Lisa, in fact, did a training with them. And we did a full day or a 2 day even training. Full day.
Full day.
Yeah. Training with the lawyers for each one of the campuses to advise them as to their legal obligations and talk to them about the way that we felt like they needed to do it. And a couple of, a handful, Michael can speak to this, a handful of these colleges are doing a pretty good job. We believe that they're doing the work, they're giving us statistics, they're talking to us, and then we've got others that have sort of disappeared on us. We've never heard from them since then. They don't communicate. How are we doing with that?
Well, I think, I mean, the tool that, again, going forward is that attorney general opinion, because then we have the power to say, our attorneys, or also your attorneys, have said that, hopefully they'll say, you need to comply. And then it makes it, we think, harder for them to say no. I think that Metro is the best example of an organization that's decided not to work with us. But
they just disappeared.
On the other side, I mean, you have schools like University of Colorado that's now offering voter registration through student registration. Granted, it's a link to online, which only hits, especially with students, a very select percentage of the population, specifically in-state students, but they're putting voter registration out there. So in addition to offering it, there are offices that assist, you know, people with disabilities and offer services to that population. So it's, you know, we're working on it, trying to encourage more participation.
I have a point of clarification. So you said Metro, and then you talked about CU. Now, I might be a little bit out of date, but the Auraria Campus Office of Disability Services serves both Metro and UCD. So when you say Metro,
It's through, when I said CU, I was referencing their student registration.
Right.
So like when you register for classes,
right,
it asks you if you want to register to vote. I don't know if Metro does that or not.
Also maybe is it a CU Boulder specific, or is it?
Probably.
It may be just CU Boulder. Just, and I think that may be both because the university administration is very proactive on that issue, but it's also Hillary Hall in Boulder County is very proactive on that issue. So you put those two things together, and I think that institution in particular has been proactive.
I think that, I want to say that the CU requirement is statewide because it came down from the regions.
Oh, really?
And so
for all students.
For all students. And then when it comes down to offices that serve people with disabilities, I was in the assumption it was an office at Metro that gave us pushback.
Yeah. And their attorneys.
Their attorneys, not necessarily the office.
Who just said, no, we're not covered by this, and we're not participating, and they basically never talked to us again.
So. That's interesting. But again, I used to be the voc rehab counselor for the Auraria campus.
You made
and I was co-located with Office of Disability Services, but that was a long, long time ago. But at that office, again, was an Auraria campus. They were Auraria employees, not Metro employees or UCD or CU employees. So that's, I'm just asking for clarification. Was this, is it now a Metro office or is it Auraria?
That was my understanding, it was Metro specific. And on Metro's website, they have a Metro specific office that serves people with disabilities. But we could be mistaken.
And this is actually a big problem we have, because we go to WIC and we say, okay, we're not getting real good responses to our request for data. And they go, you're getting it from every single one of our spots every single month. What is the problem? And we say, well, we're not getting it from Colorado Springs South, your South office, and we're not getting it from your office in Kit Carson. And, you know, we start ticking them off and they go, well, those got consolidated. The one in Colorado Springs has been consolidated with the East office, and the one in Kit Carson is now in Burlington. And we go, well, we didn't know that. You didn't tell us that. And so we don't know a lot of this stuff because we're not tapped into the actual agency world. We're only getting the data on the back end with regard to elections. So we look, you know, we see WIC compliance with the data release to be about 60%, when in fact it may be everything, because they're consolidating offices. So let's go ahead and leave this topic here, and unless anybody has any last minute questions or comments, we'll take many of your very helpful comments and try to implement them. And in fact, in the new year, we may very well want to talk to you about the great successes that we've seen in our reformatted way of doing this or that. And one of the long-term hopes is that we'll be able to, a barcode probably won't ultimately work, but have some sort of way of keeping logs of this stuff, because right now it's, I think, tick marks. You know, how many forms did I give out today? I think I gave out 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then, you know, at the end of the month, they add up the tick marks. I mean, it's really very antiquated. We really don't know what's going on in this agency. So, but I should mention, though, one thing with regard to all registration of anyone in the state of Colorado who is qualified to register to vote in the state of Colorado who is not currently registered. Hopefully, all of those people, with the exception of some people that we may miss just because of the way we collect this data, will be receiving an invitation to vote or an invitation to register to vote in the next couple of weeks when we send out our mailing under the ERIC program. When we talked about ERIC, that mailing will hit the mail stream, we believe, on September 10th. And so those county officials like Pam will be receiving a big pile full of new registrations around, you know, the 12th, 13th, 14th, and beyond. So, and that hopefully will capture some of that group that maybe is being missed. Sean?
Can I ask a quick question about that?
Sure.
At one point, you guys had discussed you doing a media plan around that. Is that still the case?
That is absolutely the case.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I was just briefed on it this morning. Let me give you a little idea of what it's looking like. Somewhere around the middle of the first week in September, so this will be after Labor Day. Is that right? Labor Day. Memorial's at the beginning, but Labor's here. A couple of days after Labor Day, we will begin a PR campaign, a PSA campaign, if you think about it that way, which will have several components to it. It will have TV, radio, bus billboards and internet, you know, boxes, you know, those advertisements on, you know, pop-ups or whatever. Hopefully we won't be so annoying as to have pop-ups, but we'll hopefully, you know, have some advertising space in on the internet and some various other functions. It's an ad campaign which will be spread across the entire state. It's not targeted at any particular audience, but instead targeted at all audiences. So it will be done in multiple languages, in multiple venues. It'll be on Spanish-speaking radio. It will, I suppose, actually in a conversation I had about it, we were talking about how if you were in the private industry, this would be a terrible way to do an ad campaign because it's not targeting anybody. It's really designed to get everybody equally. It's designed to be in all four corners. It's designed to be in populations and non-population areas. It's designed to get different audiences, not at just the people you think are going to buy or the people you think are more prone to register or something like that. We're just going after everybody. And it's a, you know, a very substantial campaign. And it will specifically be attempting to direct people to the fact that you're about to get an application to register to vote. You should be looking for it. It's coming. Oh, you should have it by now. Oh, you got it. You should be looking for that, you know, and directing them to our website so that they can register to vote. And then encouraging them broadly to then go out and vote. So that is coming and coming very soon.
I had heard a report that the secretary or that the office had purchased airtime on Spanish language television as well. Is that this, or is it something dealing with the?
That may be true. I don't know that to be the case, but that may be true. That's this. There are no other major programs we're working on right now where we would be purchasing time on a television station other than this. So, if that report is true, it's very likely this is this. But I can't speak. I know we're doing radio, but I'm not sure about TV.
Colorado Public Radio, including the public radio stations or just commercial?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I suppose that if we were going after the Volvo class, mm-hmm. the Starbucks class, we could go to public radio.
Yeah, then I don't know how
I say that. I have a Volvo in my garage right now. My wife drinks Starbucks.
So. How do you advertise on Colorado Public Radio?
You can be a sponsor.
Yeah.
It's different.
I don't know if that's quite enough to get the message out.
But I'll tell you what you can do. You can contact Mike Lamp. And he reads the news and does these little pieces.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd love to hear from you.
I will. I'll pass that along, because honestly, that also may be on the financial end of most of these relatively inexpensive. I know that when I was at a private law firm, we sponsored on NPR, our local NPR station, and they didn't mention my name on, but they had Martha's a lot. Mm-hmm. So and they sort of did the partners. I never got mentioned. It was very sad, I know it didn't actually cost all that much, so, and it was quite a lot of publicity, and we got a lot of clients because of it.
Well, Mike Lamp will do it for free.
Community radio stations, if you gave him an MP3 file, could we add this once in a while? This will do it too.
Okay. I'll mention that. Other questions? Sean, you're full of questions today. Anything else?
Well, I don't know if it's the appropriate time, but I had a question about the mailing that the Vager office sent out to potentially registered non-citizens, and sort of get an idea of what the timeline on that, how, you know, what your plan to address people that have not. So the plan to, what happens when people don't respond? What's the timeline for that? Or is it your office that might take action? Is it the clerk's office that takes action on that? It'd be nice to have some clarity on that, if you have clarity.
You know, this is, frankly, I just feel like I don't know enough to be, to comment. All I know is that last Thursday and Friday, we sent out 3,903 pieces of mail. That's what I know. So, it basically invited people who had previously used a non-citizen credential when getting a driver's license, and then at some point also became registered to vote. It invited those people to demonstrate that they were a U.S. citizen, so perhaps had subsequently become a U.S. citizen, or I suppose it's also possible that you might use a non-citizen credential when you are already a citizen. So let's say you have a green card, and you need to in some way show that you're a U.S. citizen or that you're eligible for something. You might do that. So it's asking those people to do that, and if you are not a U.S. citizen, it asks for them to cancel their registration. So it did one or the other. Beyond that, I
citing
really
the
can't.
Statute.
I can't speak intelligently.
Citing the withdrawal statute.
It would not affect their ability to apply for citizenship later. That's like I think another key thing.
I don't know the answer to that.
So there's no official plan necessarily to how those that are addressed at the moment.
There's no official plan that I'm aware of.
There is a working group that the Secretary of State has instituted that there are some counties on that working group that, and I'm not one of them, but my role in the association and what I know at this point is they're working out the memorandum of agreement with the Department of Homeland Security and hammering out that language for access to the safe database. And that work hasn't been completed yet. And beyond that, I think, you know, this letter going out for a voluntary withdrawal would be processed in our office when it got to us, as we would a withdrawal, which we do get periodically for a series of reasons under that particular statute. My office has not yet seen any of those to this point, but it's only been a few days. What happens next, there is not a lot of information about that at this point, from what I understand. But those discussions are ongoing.
Let's take a break, and we'll come back, and Hillary will tell us all about student voters and Spanish language and other language assistance for election processes upcoming. Okay, thank you.
So, Michael,
yes.
I'm happy to work with you.
Yes.
On this, but are we thinking after election?
Yeah, you saw that.
I'd like to get the request for the AGO out before.
Thank you, sir.
But I'd rather do it right than rush it. So, if it's something where I know that your efforts are going to be on the registered for the next October 9th, at least, so it could be something that, I mean, I could.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'll let them know that you would be.
I'm just happy to work with
okay.
you.
Okay.
We'll work.
We'll figure it out.
This has been a hot issue for me.
Yeah, and even if it's just, you know, we run it by you, we got something in front of you, you give comments on it, you know, something like that. Maybe that's starting point we can figure out. I'm pretty good at being able to push things back, so we'll see what I can
do. Yeah, I don't know if I have, I think I'm out of cards.
It's okay, because I know Lisa has,
right.
I think Andrea has it too, so.
Did Scott talk to everybody at the start here?
Did Scott come talk?
Oh. Is he even in town?
I didn't think so. But,
I don't know, wasn't he at the platform? Was he at the platform meeting?
Yeah.
I don't know, I mean, I have no idea.
He's going to go on a post. You could be there to serve.
I was kind of surprised when I got to think that's a standing agenda. I figure it's just automatically on every agenda.
Yeah. Although he hasn't, everyone.
No, he hasn't.
Only like three or four times.
That we spent the whole thing on NBR, which for me is a really hot topic. It's like special districts for you, Mickey. Like this,
I learned a lot.
It's a hot issue for me.
I don't know if we did it before that.
But Jed didn't tell us, but New York case took 6 years.
Are you kidding?
No.
Oh my God.
He didn't mention that.
It
was
6 years.
Yeah, it sounded
like slam dunk. I don't know. Oh no. The lawsuits were filed in 2004. Oh, jeez. That sounds If I would just look at, what is it, 8.5? Yeah, 8.5 is good, the source.
Yeah.
The what?
We don't have the statute.
I don't need the statute.
Do you want them?
I would, is it there?
You.
Hey, Kevin. Hang on, let me get rid of... That's okay. Let me get rid of the other... I'm on your answering machine. Hang on. Are you there? Are you there? Are you there? Can you hear me now? Okay. I don't know what kind of message I left you, but it'll be long. Hey, listen, quick question.
I'm looking for an email from a Bill Griffin.
I believe so.
You could. He is wanting me to speak to a men's group.
I'm waiting for Hillary. I know she'll be here.
She's supposed to be, but she's in a meeting with our team's boss. That's what I heard.
Yeah, but they like left.
Left the building?
I guess. I don't know where they went.
Good. tried that already?
No. Are you here for this whole meeting? No, I just came here a little bit. I just got in your apartment right before you walked in. What was Hank's name? I have no idea. I missed it. You got a Florida view? I guess that's a second. What's Florida? Oh, no, I'm not.
Did you read this?
I just got it.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out, is this new or is this already new? And the reason I ask is it makes it that if you're a student, you then are, you cannot be in your home once you get 30 days under the district of no state.
Well, those are
yeah, I remember it was 2008 when the clerk down in El Paso County, Bailey, got into trouble because he told all the out-of-state students at El Paso College that if their parents claimed them as a dependent on their tax form,
right,
then they were not allowed to register in Colorado, which is not true.
Okay, I was just wondering.
But I think what this, the purpose of having this out is so that we could make suggestions for changes.
I was wondering. And also, when you register, citizenship is just an affirmation. You don't have to have a birth certificate or something. I'm assuming it's just an affirmation.
Let's put my thing in.
You should never go upstairs with the lunches, because I always get dragged into about three different things.
Jack.
I saw.
You need to learn how to text message her.
Coming to grab me. Like, no, I should just stay in this room. Do not leave this room.
We'll bring you the coffee.
There you go.
Is this a work in progress? Or is
it is. This is not officially yet. It has not been formally presented or made official, which I think our hope is that it become official by the end of this week, or maybe even Monday of next week. But that's one of the reasons why we wanted to bring it to an August group like yourselves to get your thoughts on it.
I was just trying to remember in 2008 when Bob Bailink was clerk in El Paso County, he made some public statement about, or sent a letter to the students at Colorado College that he had to retract. But the nature of that was...
Well, he never really retracted. He got some serious pushback when he did it.
So he said that if you were on your parents' tax form in another state, then you were not allowed to register to vote?
He said several things like that, yeah.
Which
were incorrect or very ill-advised, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Because, frankly, as election officials, we should never be in a position where we're telling people that you don't register, don't vote. I mean, those are always bad positions for us to be in.
Yeah, why bother going there, yeah.
So Bob probably, didn't take the best, quite best tack on that one. We're discussing Bob Bailey's letter to the students in 2008.
Why would you bring back such a wonderful
memory? I didn't bring it up. He brought it up. Joe
I just was trying to remember what the rub was. And...
Yeah. Ah, the good old days.
Layers and layers and layers.
You have universities in your...
Oh,
your, what do you got?
School of Arts.
Yeah,
CCU. Not big ones.
But that's a lot of out-of-state students. At Mines, there's probably a lot of out-of-staters, no?
I don't know what the proportion is.
Out of the country.
Yeah.
right.
Yeah, I don't know what the proportion is, but. Yeah, I mean, our rule is we don't tell you if you're a resident. You decide. Your residency, not us.
Yeah,
and all the things that go with that.
Part of this discussion that we're going to get into is kind of the line that we're trying to walk. Look, we'd love for you to register. We want you to vote. But you should be aware that registering to vote has some consequences.
Which is a really, I probably should have brought that up in the last conversation is, when you're in the context of this eligibility debate, so ironic, and what we get, we operate in the middle of the political spectrum. That's where we operate.
We're the punching bag that kind of bounces.
We operate in the middle of the political spectrum, and both legally and lawsuits, and okay.
interesting when you get, you know, threatening letters from either side of the political spectrum regarding the eligibility of your registrants when we have an extraordinarily open registration system.
How about
it's
this?
It's not a poll, it's a, you know.
Are you familiar with what's happening at CU Boulder? So here's what, so I was complimenting CU Boulder before. Mm-hmm. You know, they do a great job of student registration. Well, here's also something they do. If they use our voter lookout.
Have a good summer?
To look, and they've got the personal information of people on the, you know, information that is provided to the university. They look up people who are registered to vote, seeing if they're registered to vote. And if they're not registered to vote, they use that, and they're registered to vote in another jurisdiction, they use that as a criteria against them claiming in-state position. So, yes, yep. Sure, they encourage people to register to vote, but if you don't register to vote, we're going to use your personal information to look up whether you are so that we can hold it against you.
Well, there's sort of a reference to that here.
Yeah. And we've told CU Boulder, do not do that anymore. That is not, that's an improper usage of our voter lookup, and you shouldn't even have access to that information. You know?
It's publicly available information.
Yeah. But
that's the point.
We're trying to keep the regulatory bar from having it. We understand that, you know, a student should have it, or that, you know, broad metrics should be available, but their regulatory arm should not be able to go in.
I get requests for publicly available information all the time for people that utilize it in ways that is not for voting purposes.
Yeah, right.
You know, political purposes, you know, and then I wish that people that used it for political purposes actually compared it to what we have to determine eligibility, so they don't send mailings for registration to people who died 12 years ago.
Nice
cut.
Oh, you're kidding.
Makes it easier.
Yeah. The lawsuit's really easy when you do it that way.
I think I have a point right here.
That's right. That's great. Nice. Yeah. But the real question, is he a U.S. citizen? Maybe he's not a U.S. citizen.
And he voted before.
Gosh, he's committed felony after felony after felony.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, wait a minute. He's a U.S. citizen. Forget that. That is the problem. Can I just say that is the problem? You know? DMV data, so DMV,
yes.
You always have to take DMV with a grain of salt.
Yeah, you know, brainstorming.
Yeah.
You know, trying to bring a sense of pragmatism to the conversation.
I'm so glad
my office is
in buzz. I'm so glad that we can help you make your case.
I was just saying, we operate in the middle of the political spectrum. Joe looked at me kind of funny, like you do.
Who's your partner?
No, I know. You're an equal opportunity defendant.
One or the other. Y'all are being good at me.
On what?
Andy is originally from England. On a myriad of topics.
He's been a citizen here for quite some time.
There you go.
I try not.
Share
that. I can share with our friends.
I'm bourbon, but yes. I was on a panel with my mother the other day.
Well, the other thing
I never really got a chance to meet her.
Really?
Not a panel. Because I came back.
Technically, she's my mother-in-law. But I actually like her.
That's right.
That's a good point.
She's always getting me into trouble.
So if you are 65 years of age, you'll be able to use
it. Actually, it's funny. I was driving here. And I got a phone call, and generally most parent conversations start with, I need to tell you what I did. And I'm like,
well, because it's just one of the three things that we say every time we talk about registration.
She sounded really good. She was on Colorado Public Radio last 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I haven't heard it.
It was good. She came off really, really well.
Absolutely.
Everybody, I can't remember which, I guess it was Colorado Matters. So he had just said, oh, no, it's so refreshing when our former legislators could be as honest as
that.
So good then.
Right, right.
She wanted to put you on the spot.
No,
to be able to do that.
Against Hillary, that's a very bad
to a great degree, but it is liberating.
Well, you should ask
retirement is very liberating.
It is in term limits though too. Like it's
all right, well, we
built up
the
political capital of being there for a long time. Right. You can get away with a lot more than you can when you've only got a strong window.
Absolutely, she is one of the last. The sort of grandfather clause for that. So, generally.
All right.
Yeah.
But she does like to speak about
it. Yeah, political picnics are treated sometimes
recording.
With.
We are back.
Did I tell you I'm a party in a lawsuit?
What
really?
Happened to my little mic? Right there.
Yes.
Okay, we are back on the air. Our contributor this afternoon is Hillary Rudy. You know her, you love her, you've seen her here before. She is going to tell us all about two of the quick reference guides, one quick reference guide and one sort of policy statement that our office has been crafting that will be relevant to this year's election cycle. So Hillary, take it away.
Hi everyone, good afternoon. So I want to start with student voter registration. So every 4 years, this becomes an issue, particularly in college towns, but pretty much statewide. We get questions about what about students, college students, where can they register? What does residency mean? What does that have any effect on financial aid? Sometimes some people put out statements about financial aid that may or may not be fully accurate, and it usually turns into a pretty big partisan fight. So we really wanted to get ahead of this one this year and put out a statement that we could send to the parties, the voter registration drive folks, the colleges, get it out on our website. And so that's what this first document is, this quick reference guide on student voter registration. So basically the first part of the guide takes us through qualifications to register and vote in Colorado. So 18 years older, a citizen and a resident of the precinct for at least 30 days before the election. And then it talks a little bit about deadlines and how to register to vote. And then we have a section on determining residence. And so with respect to college students in particular, residency really is about where you intend to make your residence. So you don't lose or adopt a residence solely because of your presence or absence from the state for college or military service. So if a student moves out of state to go to school and want to maintain Colorado as their residence, or come to Colorado to go to school and want to adopt Colorado as their residence, it really is the student's choice about where they choose to be a resident. And it may have an effect on financial aid in rare instances. So we do mention this down at the bottom under residency and financial aid. It's a pretty rare instance where there's an effect, but really what we wanted to point out is that it really is up to the student to speak with their financial aid office and determine what, if any, effect it would have on their financial aid. I know that particularly down in Durango, there is some effect sometimes on residency with respect to tribal scholarships. So that's one area we have seen in the past where this caused particular problems for students. But we don't think that we ought to be. We don't think we are in the business of helping folks understand, their financial aid. And it's really not the area that county clerks are experienced in either. So we definitely wanted to highlight there could be an issue, but advise students they need to go to their financial aid offices locally. So the goal with this document really is to put the facts in the hands of the students and the folks registering students and let them make their own decision, because that's really kind of the goal overall, is to let them decide where they choose to be registered to vote based on where they choose to be residents. So that's it in a nutshell. Do you guys have questions about it?
I think this will be a, no questions, but just a sorry comment. I think this will be a useful reference guide for parents of adult children as well. Get really fired up for their students' election status, so that we can provide it to them as a resource.
Yeah, I agree. We are starting to get a lot of calls, oddly not from students, but from their parents, about where their child should register to vote. So,
their adult child.
18 years of age or old.
Question. Judd, earlier you mentioned that when a student registers to vote, there's some other things that just happen, unintended consequences. Like what? Besides the financial aid, are there other things that you don't know about?
Well, they don't, it's not necessarily that one follows the other, but they can. So, one's choice to register to vote in a certain jurisdiction is indicia of of a larger choice. You know, you're choosing to reside in that state, or you're making a choice about your current status as a Coloradan, as opposed to your former status as a, you know, Indianan, you know, something like that. So it's one of the many criteria that could be used by entities to determine whether someone should be thought of as a resident of the state of Colorado or not. It doesn't necessarily mean that one follows the other, because you could register to vote and have enough other indicia which keeps you in Indiana that you can, you know, be in Colorado to register to vote and claim your residency here, but go back and reclaim your residency back in Indiana pretty easily. So it's kind of a tough walk, though, because people can get themselves into trouble, which I think is what Hillary was talking about.
Well, and the residency requirements for example, claiming in-state tuition don't really necessarily follow the residency requirements for voting. And so that's what's really important from our perspective, is advising students about what does residency mean for the purpose of voting, because it's very different for student purposes, for car registration purposes, for other purposes. And I think really our purpose here is to say, we can tell you about residency for voting, and that's what we can talk to you about. And if you need to talk to other folks about other residency issues, we can point you in the right direction.
Actually, I'm not going to ask the disability question yet. I'm going to I want to ask a different question that has nothing to do with disability. And this is Faith Gross. Motor vehicle registration. So scenario, hypothetical, student comes to Colorado to go to school from another state. He's driving a car that is registered under a parent or their parent's name. So this, and I know because I've noticed that the affirmation on the voter registration form seems to have changed and now includes, I understand that I'm a Colorado resident for income tax and motor vehicle registration purposes. So you've got a college student who decides for whatever reason that, yes, they're a Colorado resident for voting purposes, but that student is driving mom's car, which is still registered to mom, say in Indiana. Student signs the affirmation. So
signs which affirmation?
Signs the affirmation voter. That I understand, you know, the voter registration form affirmation saying, I understand I'm a Colorado resident for income tax and motor vehicle registration purposes, but the student is the driver of the car, but not the owner of the car. What is that student supposed to do?
I'm confused on
he doesn't
that.
Own the car, so it's not. I don't think
it's. If he buys a car,
yeah,
then it would have to be at that residence.
Yeah,
he would have to register it.
If he walked into the state owning a car that was licensed in another state, and then he did that, then yeah, he may be obligated to switch his registration.
It's property. Your vehicle is in property ownership.
So,
which is different than,
that would
and there
be
is
my
residency
guess.
Residency attached to the property ownership, which is a different timeline, which is 90 days,
mm-hmm.
versus residency declaring residency for voter registration, which is not a property interest in the same way.
I'll tell you why I'm concerned about this is because we hear stories that there are going to be challenges to voters' eligibility at the polls for this election. And so I'm wearing my Just Vote Colorado election protection hat right now. And so I would envision maybe you have a student drives to a polling place, parks their car, has an Indiana license plate, but is a registered Colorado voter and now is challenged because they're driving a vehicle with an out-of-state license plate.
They'll be able to show the car registration and show it's not in his name.
Voter registration challenges. Is an affidavit where the voter would then say, no, I am a resident of Colorado.
Yep.
There's no challenge for evidence as it would be for registration challenge. It's two different.
Yeah, the process at the polls is that there are a set of questions outlined both in statute and rule. So if somebody challenges that voter's registration because of residency, they're actually challenging their right to vote that day. And so there's a specific set of questions the judge asks the voter, and the voter makes the affirmations. If the voter makes the affirmations for residency and signs the affirmation swearing that they're a Colorado resident, then they're permitted to vote a regular ballot, and that's the end of the the discussion at the polls.
Okay. Now, I guess under that scenario, somebody could game it pretty easily. You know, wait until 30 days out of the election, they change their registration. As soon as the election's over, they change their registration back, and the 90-day window hasn't, you know, gone for the registration of their car. And they could, I don't think anybody does that. That's an awful lot of thinking for a 19-year-old. They're not going to be thinking that one through, I'm afraid.
No, I know that when our daughter went away to college, the car that she was driving was registered to my husband and me and had Colorado plates.
Well, and I think, you know, there's a lot of language under Colorado statute still that talks about, and particularly when you register at DMV, because you're registering, you know, when you're obtaining a Colorado driver's license, but there are certain guideposts under Colorado law that talk about what does residency mean, and it's more than just principal place of abode. It also talks about taxation sorts of guideposts, but under the current state of Colorado law, including all of the case law, residency really more is about intent now, and all of those other factors, including taxation, are more guideposts to help you determine where have you claimed your residency. So it's just sort of the way that the law has evolved in Colorado on residency over the past 20, 30 years.
So is that statement then on the voter registration form, that self-affirmation, is that driven by statute?
You know, I would have to look at the application itself, but the affirmation in statute basically states that they affirm as to their qualifications, so 18, a citizen and a resident of the precinct and address, and that they have adopted Colorado as their sole legal residence and claim no other. There may be a warning on there, which is statutorily required. I can't recall off the top of my head, but there's some language in statute that does talk about understanding that, you know, there are these other guideposts for registration, but I can't recall exactly what's on the form off the top of my head.
I bring it up because as a voter registration drive, I don't recall it being on the form in previous years, and all of a sudden it was on the form, and it just seems like, yeah, it's on the form now. It's the last sentence in the affirmation. I understand that by registering to vote in Colorado, I am a Colorado resident for income tax and motor vehicle registration purposes.
You know how recent that one is.
I got it today.
She got it today.
This is the verifications from the general.
That's going to be different.
Yeah. That's the one that got sent out.
Unfortunately, I don't have any VRD forms with me, but it's the I know this well because I read when I'm helping somebody fill out the form. I read that affirmation, self affirmation, to them before they sign the form.
Okay, I'll take a look at it. Yeah,
it seemed to me it feels intimidating.
Yeah, I was just curious.
On this form, determining residence for registration, I noticed specifically you don't mention dormitory in the list of dwellings, house, condo, apartment. So dormitory is not mentioned because the next sentence, a person's residence is determined where he or she intends to remain indefinitely. I guess no one goes into a dormitory expecting to be there indefinitely. But the real what we're driving at, though, is whether this person plans to make Colorado their state of residence indefinitely, and not that particular address or building or dormitory. Something to look at there.
We'll take a look at that, but under the laws and the rules, typically you adopt a place as your residence. So for students, for voters residing in a house or a home, for pretty much any Colorado voter, when we talk about residency, we're talking about the place that you've adopted as your principal home or place of abode. So we really do mean the location. I think, you know, dormitory isn't listed here because this is not an exhaustive list. Frankly, I come from a residence life background, so I don't like to call them dormitories, but that could be why. I don't know.
Residence hall.
Yeah.
But there, there are temporary locations,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, yeah. It could be added, though.
Good point. Okay.
Yeah, it's tricky when we learn that 1 out of 5 Americans are moving once a year from one apartment or house to the next.
to make that the determining feature, the actual address, I'm not going to be there indefinitely, but I am going to be in Colorado indefinitely.
Well, I think we have to, for registration purposes, tie it to the address, though, because that's fundamentally how we determine what ballot you get. And so that's why when we talk about your home, we talk about what, you know, where are we precincting you? I mean, that's sort of what we're driven by. Yeah.
So could you put out a similar type of quick reference guide for people who are homeless? Because mailing address is a huge problem.
We actually do have FAQs directed specifically to homeless voter registration on our website. I think that we don't have them consolidated into a quick reference, but it would be very easy to do that. But we absolutely do have those same set of kind of question answer format for homeless voters.
So consider this a formal request for such a document. Thank you. And then if nobody else now, I'll ask the disability question.
Absolutely, go for it.
It's such a pain in the butt.
No, we love you.
So, and Hillary and I, we've already, but I want this for the whole group and for the record. So on this student voter registration quick guide, you have the electors exempt under federal law, electors who are 65 years or older, electors with disabilities, and military or overseas electors. Could you please explain that?
The electors exempt under federal law?
The exemption for first-time electors who register by mail.
Sure. Under federal law, the Help America Vote Act and a couple of other federal laws combined, but primarily the Help America Vote Act. Electors who are eligible to vote by mail federally, which include electors who are 65 years or older, electors with disability, and military and overseas electors, are exempt from the requirement under the Help America Vote Act that if you register to vote by mail the first time that you vote, you must provide a copy of ID unless we verified the ID or you're exempt. So the HAVA reads a little bit backwards, the requirement in HAVA, but basically, under the federal law, electors who fall into this federally eligible to vote by mail category still must complete the application and provide the ID number if they have it, so the driver's license number or last four social security number, but they're exempt from the requirement that they provide a copy of ID when they vote by mail because they're federally eligible to vote by mail.
So a couple questions. One is, how does the county clerk know that the person is a person with a disability?
We don't. So the other two categories are pretty easy, obviously, because SCORE, the statewide database, calculates age, and that's pretty evident. And military and overseas is also pretty evident because they usually affirm it for us. But otherwise, the training that we've given the counties is that if you receive an application and you attempt to verify the number provided and are unable to, then the record is flagged as needing to provide ID the first time they vote. So everyone provides ID if you go to the polls, so it's really, this affects people who vote by mail. If an elector responds that they are exempt under federal law because they have a disability, then we take that at face value because there's no way for a county clerk to ask that up front. It's not okay to say, you know, oh, are you disabled, right? We wouldn't want them to ask that, first of all, for a lot of reasons. So we take it at face value if the elector advises us that they are. The issue here really is that I don't believe that electors affected by that law necessarily know.
And that was the point I was just going to make, is that I would be surprised if even half of a percent of the people, voters with disabilities in Colorado, know that they're exempt from this ID requirement.
Right. Which is why we do try to put this information on the mail-in ballot application. It's on the FAQs on the back. And we do put it out on our website. We try and let, you know, VRDs know. But really, like Carol said, at the end of the day, the burden is sort of on the voter to advise us. But again, I would be really uncomfortable with the counties asking.
And I'm with you. I'd be yelling pretty loudly.
I figured, yeah.
Does this only apply to federal elections?
It does not. We've adopted it under Colorado law. Okay. So basically under our state law registration laws, it says that if you're exempt under federal law, the ID requirement at voting does not apply.
Thank you.
For voting by mail.
Now, is this in effect? When is it going to be in effect? what is the time frame here?
The time frame for putting out the quick reference guide, we've you know, gone over a few drafts internally. We've shared it with the party attorneys. We've shared it with you now. Our plan is really to get this out there within the next week or so because, you know, students are checking in now and we're, you know, just months out from the election. So now is the time to get it in the hands of everyone.
So it would be at schools and it would be on the web.
Yeah, we'll put it on our website, send it out to the county clerks. We've talked a lot about this with the counties, particularly that have college students, high populations of college students. So we'll send it out to the counties. We'll also make it available to voter registration drives. And we've talked a little bit about sending this to colleges as well. Other questions? Okay, so the other document, this started a couple of years ago, actually, when we started looking at the 2010 census data, well, sort of the pre-2010 census data, and trying to sort out, you know, which counties might be required to provide assistance under the Voting Rights Act. So we've been working with counties for a couple of years on language minority assistance, language assistance. And as many of you know, when the 2010 census information came out, we went from, I believe, 10 covered counties down to 3 covered counties. So Denver and Castilla and Rio Grande counties are all required under federal law to provide bilingual election materials. But there are a lot of other counties that expect it to become covered just because of their knowledge of their county populations. And a number of counties that do have relatively high language minority populations despite not being covered. So we continue to meet with the counties and discuss, you know, what are they doing? What do they plan to do? And out of those pretty regular best practice meetings with the counties came this document, which is just an assistance best practices. So if counties aren't covered, they may still be required to provide translation services under state law, which says if you have, I want to say 5% or more of any precinct is a language minority, you have to provide translators at the polls or in your office. So some counties fall under that category, but a lot of counties felt like that wasn't really, it was a minimum accommodation, but maybe there was more that they ought to be doing. So we worked with the counties to develop this, and we also shared it with the secretary's Hispanic roundtable. But basically, there are a couple categories where counties feel like they ought to be making some accommodations if they have high language minority populations. And that's in translated materials and instructions, verbal assistance, either in their offices, at their polls, and then signage. And so in terms of translated materials, counties, we provide, because for statewide issues and questions, the information is translated. So we provide that to all counties. So a lot of counties that have a high percentage of Spanish-speaking population will also provide that information for the state issues and questions. They'll link up to the Blue Book. The state provides a Spanish translation version of the Blue Book. We link to it on our website, so counties will do the same. A lot of counties are also providing some additional translation materials on their website. So, you know, information for voters, frequently asked questions, voter information materials, and may provide additional information upon the request of the voter. So these counties aren't required by federal law to send all of this out, so they're not doing that, but they're providing it both on their website and upon request. In the voter instructions, several counties have chosen to include a statement in Spanish advising Spanish-speaking electors how to get assistance if they need it, whether it's to point them to the website or point them to a resource in their office. So you can see under the voter instructions, there's a translated sentence there. And this is an attractive option for a lot of counties because, you know, leading up to the 2010 determinations, there are a couple of counties with very high Spanish-speaking populations that were kind of put in a pretty tough position. If they had become covered, they would have had a significant portion of, you know, their population, a significant portion of their commissioner boards in some cases, that were very frustrated with translating all of the materials across the board. But the county clerk felt like it was important to provide assistance. So this is an option where they can give the assistance to folks who really want that assistance. Counties also are, you know, considering making copies of the the local voter instructions, local questions, all of that really is up to the local jurisdiction. So down to a state level, they'll definitely provide the information because it's already translated. But in terms of county questions, that's a question for the county commissioners. And then if they coordinate with local jurisdictions, it's a question for the local jurisdiction, because obviously there's a cost associated with that translation. So that has to be accounted for in the intergovernmental agreements, and that's a decision for the local governments in terms of, you know, whether they want to bear that cost or not. But basically, as much information as is provided, the counties will make that available. In terms of translators and bilingual election judges, counties with high populations of Spanish-speaking voters are making sure that they have folks on staff that can assist. In some cases where staff is a restricted resource, they're looking into, you know, phone options or consolidated options across counties. So they're getting pretty creative in terms of resources. And then they're also working pretty hard to recruit bilingual election judges. I know that a lot of counties have asked, you know, the Common Cause and Mi Familia, when they've been out to visit them, if they can help recruit bilingual election judges. Because it's pretty difficult, actually, to recruit folks who are fluent in both English and Spanish to work as election judges. And in the county's experience, it's hard enough to find people to work as election judges, much less layer on the additional qualification that you're fluent in two languages. So counties are definitely reaching out to find additional resources. And then a lot of counties have also made sure that they have bilingual signage. So we provide all of the polling place signs in bilingual format, and a lot of counties are also putting up bilingual signage in their election offices just as a matter of business. So counties are definitely doing everything they can to provide as much assistance as possible, given, you know, kind of the resources that they're restricted with right now. I think that particularly some of the smaller counties were looking at getting pretty creative if they had been covered this go around. But they're also looking forward to 2016, which is when the next census evaluation will be done, because I think many counties are very mindful that they didn't become covered through this go around, but that's still a very real possibility in 5 years. So that's something everybody's looking forward to.
So they do those based on the estimates in the mid-year?
Yeah, that was a change with the coverage under the Voting Rights Act this last go-around. Now that they do the American Community Survey every 5 years, they will do a reevaluation of language minority coverage every 5 years following the community survey based on those estimates.
Last one was Denver, Costilla, and which county?
Rio Grande.
Rio Grande, three.
I noticed one thing that wasn't on this, and that was the published notice of election. Mm-hmm. Was there a reason why that was not put on there? Because I know, obviously, in the mandatory counties, we do that. But there's also some counties that are doing it voluntarily, and they are requiring that we also translate the published notice.
Yeah. That really is it's a question that we talked a lot about in the best practices meeting, and ultimately it came down to a local decision. One of the reasons that it's not on the best practices list ultimately was cost. It's a big cost. I think that there are counties that had been covered, probably will continue doing the published notice. Not all of them, but I know a number of them are still continuing to do that and are asking local jurisdictions to pay for the translation of the published notice as well.
And we would have no choice.
Iron it out in the IGAs is what I tell the counties. Make sure you know who's on first.
It doesn't change, the language doesn't change that much from election to election, but is it?
Well, the published notice of election usually includes all of the issues and questions as well.
So it does.
And the blue book is like the Tabor notice.
Right.
Yeah, that's completely different. This is a notice of elections required to be published prior to the election. For a polling place election, it's at least 10 days prior. Mail ballot is at least 20 days prior. So that's completely different.
It will be different for each election then.
Yeah.
And the cost associated with the publication is usually actually primarily the cost of publishing with the newspaper, which increases exponentially with the decreasing size of the newspaper.
One other question. Say a little Polish grandmother who has the right to vote wants someone to come into the polling booth with them to translate. What's the rule on that? They want to bring their kid in, or
Is that allowed?
Absolutely. So we actually just made some changes to our state law last year to square up with federal law. Under federal law, any person that the elector chooses to assist them may assist them. We require anybody other than an election judge who assists to sign a form because we need them to affirm that they will not attempt to influence or sway the voter in any way. But if the elector wants to bring in their child or grandchild to translate for them, they absolutely can do that.
Can I just, I'd like to share a remarkable story with, as you might remember from the last meeting, Denver invited me to observe a couple of their iPad pilot sites for the primary election. And we were at an apartment building that had a lot of Russian folks who had been Russian immigrants, now citizens, who were voting and were not proficient in English. And just coincidentally and truly amazingly, one of the election judges that Denver sent out was fluent in Russian. It was a coincidence. It was not intentional. And it was remarkable to see this woman, this election judge, translating for all these elderly Russian voters. But when I talked with the Denver folks afterwards, it was a complete coincidence.
Won't be next time.
No, yeah. Well, it was one of those things that just made your heart feel good. It was great to see.
Well, that is one of the challenges, actually, especially for the metro area, is that, you know, this focuses on Spanish-speaking voters, right? Because that's one of the covered languages under the Voting Rights Act. But the bigger challenge for the metro counties is actually Russian, Hmong, and Vietnamese. So, I mean, there's some a completely different demographic out there that the Voting Rights Act covers to an extent, but not necessarily. And Russian is one that the Voting Rights Act does not cover. So the counties are facing other language assistance challenges and tackling them much in the same way, but really the focus in Colorado has been on language assistance for Spanish-speaking voters.
Any other questions for Heather?
Thanks.
So these will become official policy very soon, or at least the quick reference guide will.
Yeah. Well, the language assistance best practices, we've worked on this with the counties. We've shared it with them. We'll ask them for feedback one last time based on their experience in the primary. And then I suspect we'll get it out there as official and final within the next couple of weeks as well, so that we can begin preparing for the general.
Thank you, Hillary. Okay.
Thanks, guys.
So we had an official piece of business that we started the meeting with that we were unable to complete. Kevin, I believe you made a motion originally.
No.
Who was it that made the motion? Was Pam the person that made the motion? Somebody on this side of the table. Can, I will move.
I will, minutes?
I will move that we agree to the minutes. Anybody want a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Good. That was nice to get out.
I don't think it was motion. I think it was a question.
You asked the question.
And now, would you mind pulling out your calendars and we can go for the future meetings? Because I don't think we have anything scheduled beyond this. Is that right? I'm pretty sure that that's correct.
Besides October the tour of the...
We have an October
date. We
have an October tour.
Oh, well, the tour.
Oh, for the yeah. tour.
Yeah.
We could make that our October meeting. Would you like to... make that our October meeting? Actually,
sure.
That's not a bad
that's
idea
not
at all.
I thought that was.
Okay, so we will make that our October meeting. We actually have a great agenda item, which we can push to December, which is perfectly fine, which is how we do petition verification for initiatives. I think that'll be a great item, and who knows, we may have more fresh jurisprudence because, of course, every election cycle brings with it the chance for a new lawsuit. So you never know. We may not make it out of this one without another lawsuit. By the way, you may hear on the news later today that the Common Cause submission for a campaign finance, it's got a campaign finance language, it's number 82, failed the random sample and will now go to a line-by-line sample. So our line-by-line review. So that is now beginning. We will begin that today.
What does that mean?
So under,
under
state law, it means that they have to meet, they have to get to 86,105.
Right.
That's their number. And the way we measure that is we do a 5% random sample of all of what they submit. And if the percentage that they attain can be extrapolated into the original amount that they submitted, and that comes out at 110% or more of that number of 86,105, then we don't do anything more. We say yes, and we put it on the ballot. They did not get to 110%. So we're going to need to go back and do a line by line. Under state law, we have to line by line everything that falls within 90 and 110%. So if it's just missed below or just missed or just got in above, we have to go through and do all of that. So that will be made public later today.
What's the company that does that in Pueblo?
It's not a company. It's part of DPA. It's part of the Department of Public Administration. And that is IDS is what they do that. And they're a service that DPA provides that does a lot of a kind of like rudimentary accounting procedures for the state. So all of the state income tax receipts go through that office and they catalog them and all that stuff. And we have trained them how to do our petition reviews.
Does Common Cause know that already?
We have notified Common Cause.
Do you have any updates on the other pending?
Personhood is the other one, which is number 46. And 46 is in a line-by-line right now. They also failed the random sample. And they are in a line-by-line, and we anticipate that their line-by-line will be finished maybe even this week. So in the next couple of days, we might be able to tell publicly whether they made it or not. So we're doing two line-by-lines. One had 106,000 signatures, which was Common Cause. 106,000 is a low number.
That was 176,000.
Not for
82.
For 82. 82 is what did I say?
Common Cause.
For Common Cause.
Okay.
They submitted 180,000.
Okay.
I meant to say Personhood. Personhood submitted 106,000. So Personhood submitted significantly fewer, but had a much higher rate of compliance with review. And Common Cause had that much lower. So they both ended up in the random. So we're going to have to do basically, what would that be, 300,000 signatures, signature reviews. And we have under statute 30 days. If we don't get it done in 30 days, it goes on the ballot. So we've got to do our review in 30 days, and we have never in the history of our office missed a 30-day deadline, and we're not going to miss it this year. So.
And that's 30 days starting, what, August 7th?
On August 6th. So August 6th was the submission day. Yeah, August 7th. So the next day started our 30-day window.
So. When's the October meeting again?
That's October 25th, and we are meeting at Jefferson County. We're going to get more information from Pam, but we're going to meet to go through her facility. We're going to take a tour of her facility.
Her new elections offices.
Votes will be coming in, so we'll be able to watch them process and watch them do signature verification. And
great.
It should be a lot of fun. So, and I'll get you more details on that as I know them. So thank you all for coming. And actually, let's set a December one while we're here. That's good. And then we'll start anew with January and beyond. So let me get my calendar. Last year we did this on my birthday. Let's not do that. We could go with the 12th or the 19th? Does either of those look better than the other? 12th. 12th it is. 12th by affirmation.
10th.
1 to 4 here. And I will send out an official notice, but just count on it being here. free. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
You.
Please apologize to Karen and her family for us. Well. We live in exciting times.
It's an interesting talk.
Oh, what's this?
An old speech from, 11 years ago, but I'm a Francis Fukuyama fan. She doesn't mention the biggest reason I learned at the last meeting. People were afraid of getting called into GED because it was...
Put on our forms and stuff, on our test mailing for Eric, we put on there, don't worry, this won't affect your likelihood of being called for jury duty.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Sure, I'll
Thank you. The first thing was they needed 82%, which was extraordinarily high, and they got 79.5 or so.